It is said that the Duke Leto blinded himself to the perils of Arrakis, that he walked heedlessly into the pit. Would it not be more likely to suggest he had lived so long in the presence of extreme danger, he misjudged a change in its intensity? Or is it possible he deliberately sacrificed himself that his son might find a better life? All evidence indicates the Duke was a man not easily hoodwinked. From Muad'Dib, Family Commentaries, by the Princess Irulan. The Duke Leto Atreides leaned against a parapet of the landing control tower outside Arrakeen. The night's first moon, an oblate silver coin, hung well above the southern horizon. Beneath it, the jagged cliffs of the shield wall shone like parched icing through a dust haze. To his left, the lights of Arrakeen glowed in the haze, yellow, white, blue. He thought of the notices posted now above his signature all through the populous places of the planet. "Our sublime Padishah Emperor has charged me to take possession of this planet and end all dispute." The ritualistic formality of it touched him with a feeling of loneliness. Who was fooled by that fatuous legalism? Not the Fremen, certainly, nor the houses minor who controlled the interior trade of Arrakis, and were hearkening creatures almost to a man. "They have tried to take the life of my son." The rage was difficult to suppress. He saw lights of a moving vehicle coming toward the landing field from Arrakeen. He hoped it was the guard and troop carrier bringing Paul. The delay was galling, even though he knew it was prompted by caution on the part of Howitt's lieutenant. "They have tried to take the life of my son." He shook his head to drive out the angry thoughts, glanced back at the field where five of his own frigates were posted around the rim like monolithic sentries. Better a cautious delay than... The lieutenant was a good one, he reminded himself. A man marked for advancement, completely loyal. "Our sublime Padishah Emperor. If the people of this decadent garrison city could only see the Emperor's private note to his noble Duke, the disdainful allusions to veiled men and women. But what else is one to expect of barbarians whose dearest dream is to live outside the ordered security of the Falfreluches?" The Duke felt in this moment that his own dearest dream was to end all class distinctions and never again think of deadly order. He looked up and out of the dust at the unwinking stars, thought, "Around one of those little lights circles Caladan. But I'll never again see my home." The longing for Caladan was a sudden pain in his breast. He felt that it did not come from within himself, but that it reached out to him from Caladan. He could not bring himself to call this dry wasteland of Arrakis his home, and he doubted he ever would. "I must mask my feelings," he thought, "for the boy's sake. If ever he's to have a home, this must be it. I may think of Arrakis as a hell I've reached before death, but he must find here that which will inspire him. There must be something." A wave of self-pity, immediately despised and rejected, swept through him, and for some reason he found himself recalling two lines from a poem Gurney Halleck often repeated. "My lungs taste the air of time, blown past falling sands." Well, Gurney would find plenty of falling sands here, the Duke thought. The central wastelands beyond those moon-frosted cliffs were desert. Barren rock, dunes, and blowing dust, an uncharted dry wilderness with here and there along its rim and perhaps scattered through it, knots of Fremen. If anything could buy a future for the Atreides line, the Fremen just might do it. Provided the Harkonnens hadn't managed to infect even the Fremen with their poisonous schemes. They have tried to take the life of my son. A scraping metal racket vibrated through the tower, shook the parapet beneath his arms. Blast shutters dropped in front of him, blocking the view. Shuttle's coming in, he thought. Time to go down and get to work. He turned to the stairs behind him, headed down to the big assembly room, trying to remain calm as he descended, to prepare his face for the coming encounter. They have tried to take the life of my son. The men were already boiling in from the field when he reached the yellow-domed room. They carried their space bags over their shoulders, shouting and roistering like students returning from vacation. Hey, feel that under your dogs? That's gravity, man. How many G's does this place pull? Feels heavy. 9/10 of a G by the book. The crossfire of thrown words filled the big room. Did you get a good look at this hole on the way down? Where's all the loot this place is supposed to have? The Harkonnens took it with them. Me for a hot shower and a soft bed. Haven't you heard, stupid? No showers down here. You scrub your ass with sand. Hey, Kennet, the Duke. The Duke stepped out of the stair entry into a suddenly silent room. Gurney Halleck strode along at the point of the crowd, bag over one shoulder, the neck of his 9-string baliset clutched in the other hand. They were long-fingered hands with big thumbs, full of tiny movements that drew such delicate music from the baliset. The Duke watched Halleck, admiring the ugly lump of a man, noting the glass splinter eyes with their gleam of savage understanding. Here was a man who lived outside the Fauvreluches while obeying their every precept. What was it Paul had called him? Gurney the Valorous. Halleck's wispy blonde hair trailed across barren spots on his head. His wide mouth was twisted into a pleasant sneer, and the scar of the inkvine whip slashed across his jawline seemed to move with a life of its own. His whole air was of casual, shoulder-set capability. He came up to the Duke, bowed. Gurney, Leto said. My lord? He gestured with a baliset toward the men in the room. This is the last of them. I'd have preferred coming in with the first wave, but there are still some Harkonnens for you, the Duke said. Step aside with me, Gurney, where we may talk. Yours to command, my lord. They moved into an alcove beside a coil slot water machine while the men stirred restlessly in the big room. Halleck dropped his bag into a corner, kept his grip on the baliset. How many men can you let Howard have? The Duke asked. Is Thufir in trouble, sire? He's lost only 2 agents, but his advance men gave us an excellent line on the entire Harkonnen setup here. If we move fast, we may gain a measure of security, the breathing space we require. He wants as many men as you can spare. Men who won't balk at a little knife work. I can let him have 300 of my best, Halleck said. Where shall I send them? To the main gate. Howard has an agent there waiting to take them. Shall I get about it at once, sire? In a moment. We have another problem. The field commandant will hold the shuttle here until dawn on a pretext. The guild highliner that brought us is going on about its business, and the shuttle is supposed to make contact with a cargo ship taking up a load of spice. Our spice, my lord. Our spice. But the shuttle also will carry some of the spice hunters from the old regime. They've opted to leave with the change of fief, and the judge of the change is allowing it. These are valuable workers, Gurney. about 800 of them. Before the shuttle leaves, you must persuade some of those men to enlist with us. How strong a persuasion, sire? I want their willing cooperation, Gurney. Those men have experience and skills we need. The fact that they're leaving suggests they're not part of the Harkonnen machine. Howitt believes there could be some bad ones planted in the group, but he sees assassins in every shadow. Thufir has found some very productive shadows in his time, my lord. And there are some he hasn't found. But I think planting sleepers in this outgoing crowd would show too much imagination for the Harkonnens. Possibly, sire. Where are these men? Down on the lower level, in a waiting room. I suggest you go down and play a tune or two to soften their minds, then turn on the pressure. You may offer positions of authority to those who qualify. Offer 20% higher wages than they received under the Harkonnens. No more than that, sire. I know the Harkonnen pay scales. And to men with their termination pay in their pockets and the wanderlust on them. Well, sire, 20% would hardly seem proper inducement to stay. Leto spoke impatiently. Then use your own discretion in particular cases. Just remember that the treasury isn't bottomless. Hold it to 20% whenever you can. We particularly need spice drivers, weather scanners, dune men, any with open sand experience. I understand, sire. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity of the sand. A very moving quotation, the Duke said. Turn your crew over to a lieutenant. Have him give a short drill on water discipline, then bed the men down for the night in the barracks adjoining the field. Field personnel will direct them. And don't forget the men for Howitt. 300 of the best, sire. He took up his space bag. Where shall I report to you when I've completed my chores? I've taken over a council room topside here. We'll hold staff there. I want to arrange a new planetary dispersal order with armored squads going out first. Halleck stopped in the act of turning away, caught Leto's eye. Are you anticipating that kind of trouble, sire? I thought there was a judge of the change here. Both open battle and secret, the Duke said. There'll be blood aplenty spilled here before we're through. And the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land, Halleck quoted. The Duke sighed. Hurry back, Gurney. Very good, my lord. The whip scar rippled to his grin. Behold, as a wild ass in the desert, go I forth to my work. He turned, strode to the center of the room, paused to relay his orders, hurried on through the men. Leto shook his head at the retreating back. Halleck was a continual amazement. A head full of songs, quotations, and flowery phrases, and the heart of an assassin when it came to dealing with the Harkonnens. Presently, Leto took a leisurely diagonal course across to the lift, acknowledging salutes with a casual hand wave. He recognized a propaganda corpsman, stopped to give him a message that could be relayed to the men through channels. Those who had brought their women would want to know the women were safe and where they could be found. The others would wish to know that the population here appeared to boast more women than men. The Duke slapped the propaganda man on the arm, a signal that the message had top priority to be put out immediately, then continued across the room. He nodded to the men, smiled, traded pleasantries with a subaltern. Command must always look confident, he thought. All that faith riding on your shoulders while you sit in the critical seat and never show it. He breathed a sigh of relief when the lift swallowed him, and he could turn and face the impersonal doors. They have tried to take the life of my son.